Good morning and welcome to Grand Rounds. We're going to try something a little different this morning, a little tripartite presentation with three presenters. The title of today's Grand Rounds is Prostate Cancer, Current Management and Future Directions. I'm going to just give a little, go over the CVs of each of our three presenters and then we'll get started. So David Taub is going to talk about prostate cancer screening. Dr. Taub is a medical urologist. He receives his medical education from Wayne State University in Detroit. After completing his residency at University of Michigan, he instructed residents in the Ann Arbor VA Medical Center, and in 2017 received an MBA from Michigan. He developed niche and minimally invasive treatment of urologic malignancies and utilizes robotic surgery for partial nephrectomy for treating kidney cancer and has significant experience performing robotic prostatectomy. He joined the Lynn Cancer Institute in July 2017. Dr. Greg Golden is a radiation oncologist, and he recently joined the Lynn Cancer Center in radiation oncology. He's originally from Boca and completed his medical degree at the University of Miami School of Medicine. He participated in the regional program affiliated with the University of Miami at the time at FAU, where he spent his first 2 years in medical school. He did a preliminary internship year at the University of Florida at Shands and did his residency in radiation oncology at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and did his first 2 years of practice in Asheville. And now for our veteran, Dr. Alan Kaletsky, receives medical education from Case Western and completed his residency in internal medicine at the University of Vermont and did a postdoc fellowship in medical oncology at Yale. He's board certified in internal medicine and medical oncology. He's currently in practice at Boca Regional Lynn Cancer Institute. He's a clinical assistant professor of biomedical science at the Charles E. Schmidt School of Medicine at FAU, and was named one of South Florida's most highly regarded physicians in 2002. Dr. Taub's going to start off with his topic is the controversy over prostate cancer screening. David?
Good morning. Thank you all for being here and letting me share a little bit of my passion about prostate cancer with you. I'd like to share some information on prostate cancer screening. I'm going to try to get an hour lecture into 15 minutes, so I'll go quick, and there's a lot of information in the slides. We may skip through some. I want to thank Dr. Kaletsky for inviting me to join him today and Dr. Golden in terms of sharing our prostate cancer expertise and just how fortunate we are to be able to work together in a multidisciplinary, multimodality clinic. We share every other week on Friday afternoon, where we see complex urologic malignancy cases, review them together, and the patients all see us in one setting. So this is what our patients think of prostate cancer screening. So we have to be mindful of what we're doing. So. Quick history, prostate cancer is the most common cancer in the United States, about 180,000 cases diagnosed this year. Second most common cause of cancer death in American men to lung cancer, about 26,000 men will die this year of prostate cancer. So what are the high risk groups, the risk factors? African American men, 50% more likely to have prostate cancer and more aggressive prostate cancer than Caucasians. BRCA positive gene mutation, very high risk for prostate cancer. 1 in 3 men with BRCA gene mutation will have prostate cancer. We actually just diagnosed one with MRI fusion biopsy last week. And so men, this is where the family history comes in. If there's a strong family history of breast cancer, may want to get them tested. And then family history, strong family history in a first degree relative, brother, sibling, father, in a younger age is associated with more aggressive and earlier onset of prostate cancer. So screening is a thorough history, a rectal examination, a prostate examination, and a PSA blood test. Most organizational bodies are recommending between 50 and 75. Starting a little earlier for high-risk groups that we mentioned, never really before 40. And you want to make sure the patient has a life expectancy over 10 years, and this is always done in a shared decision-making model where you talk about the risks and benefits of screening, the risks of biopsy, which are negligible, but then the risk of finding a clinically insignificant cancer, which can be devastating for the patient. So this is the picture of the PSA molecule. This is where all the controversy began. 1970, it was discovered. It's this will come into play later, but it's a kallikrein protein. It's secreted by prostatic epithelial cells. It is a serine protease. It lyses the seminal clot and dissolves cervical mucus so that the sperm can impregnate a woman's egg. It was first commercially available in 1986, but became really more commonly used in the early 1990s. And basically, before the PSA test, prostate cancer was diagnosed based on prostate examination, so at a more advanced stage. Any changes in the architecture of the prostate gland can have the PSA molecule reflux into the vascular channels and have a rise in PSA. So that would be benign growth, inflammation, infection, any trauma from catheter, bicycle riding, and, of course, malignancy. So when the test first came out, okay, if you're under 4, your PSA is fine. If you're over 4, it's not. And clearly we've found out over the years that it's not that simple. That was what we were taught in medical school, and it's a lot different than that. It's clearly a continuous variable. 26% of men with PSA between 3 and 4 have prostate cancer, and 20% of these cancers are high grade. So it's definitely much more of a continuous variable. And there's really no way to optimize it without major concessions. If you set the threshold too high, you're going to miss some serious high-grade malignancies. If you set it too low, you're going to get more and more false positives. So that's where some other tests come in to be more precise, and we'll talk about them shortly. So in 2008, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommended that prostate cancer screening be stopped at age 75. In 2012, they said it was more harm than good and recommended against prostate cancer screening for everyone. So this is kind of the beginning of the controversy. They had a quote in their report that said it results in small or no reduction in prostate cancer-specific mortality with unnecessary harms. So they based that on two major reports. One was the European randomized study of screening for prostate cancer, and one was done in the United States, prostate, lung, colon, and ovarian cancer screening trial, often referred to as PLCO. So the European trial was in the early 90s, 180,000 men. There were two cohorts, one screening every 4 years with PSA and DRE, and other without screening. At 13 years of follow-up, which some of this came out after the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force report, so they had less good data. But at 13 years, clearly many more men in the screen group had cancer, but many less deaths in the screen group. And so it resulted in 27% reduction in the risk of prostate cancer-specific mortality in the screen group, decrease in metastatic disease by 40%, clearly a successful trial. However, there were more overdiagnosis in the screen group. And I know Dr. Alexander and the residents start learning about number needed to treat. So the number needed to treat is 98 men screened, 5 men treated for one life saved. And those numbers are very favorable when you compare them to other interventions in the medical literature. The PLCO trial done in the United States, two cohorts, one annual screening for 6 years. Other was usual care in a heavy degree of quotation marks because there was some screening in those. The bottom line is, and this is what the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force based a lot of their information on, there was no difference between the control group and the screen group. However, when you look back, 74% of men in the usual care or control arm were screened at least once. So you're comparing apples to apples, and of course there was no difference. Another point from that trial is over 90% of prostate cancers found in the control arm were T1 or T2, which is coincides with screening. So basically, of course, that didn't show anything. It was two groups that were very similar. Finally, one study that was not considered was from Sweden. Over 20,000 men aged 50 to 64, and that becomes important, were screened for 14-year follow-up. 44% decrease in risk of prostate cancer mortality. Again, a very favorable number needed to treat numbers. And so why was this study so positive when others weren't as much? And younger population, longer follow-up, and a lower PSA threshold used to prompt biopsy. And also in Sweden, there was basically a true control group. They didn't have prostate cancer screening as a regular basis of their national health system at that time. And so these are some of the harms that the U.S. Preventative Task Force looked at. The biopsy harms are small. The real harm that is an overdiagnosis, and how do we deal with that? Diagnosing men with clinically insignificant prostate cancer. So more recent literature looking back at the 5 years since that release, number of reports showing decreased incidence of early stage prostate cancer and lower rates of PSA screening. So that, that's not necessarily all bad, but it basically, there's been other reports that show a shift towards tumor being higher grade, higher stage upon detection, and a rise in incidence of metastatic disease at diagnosis, which will ultimately lead to a higher mortality rate. So what PSA screening has done has led to a profound stage migration. So we've taken prostate cancer that was metastatic on diagnosis and made it earlier stage incurable. And there's some statistics here. In 1991, the dawn of the PSA era, 20% of men were found to have bony metastasis at diagnosis. Now it's in the 4% range. In 1990, the death rate was 38.6 per 100,000 men with prostate cancer. Now it's 19.1. So there's throughout the literature, a 40 to 70% decrease in the number of deaths attributable to prostate cancer screening. Now, of course, some of the decreased death rate is to what Dr. Kaletsky will talk about in terms of treatments for advanced prostate cancer. So this is basically showing in the pre-PSA era, one-third of patients that were thought to be clinically localized had positive lymph nodes. Two-thirds had advanced disease on pathologic examination. Today, 50% of cases are clinical stage T1C or diagnosed by PSA, and 75% of tumors are organ confined at surgery, which leads to eligibility for nerve sparing, so better functional outcomes, decreased risk of needing adjunctive therapies, lower cost and morbidity for the patient. This is an important slide talking about some limitations of prostate cancer screening. So if you get a first PSA and it's high, the thought 10, 20 years ago was give antibiotics and it comes down. And what we found is that the PSA can fluctuate over time, and so just check another PSA. Basically, giving the antibiotics without UTI-like symptoms is just going to maybe predispose to a resistant organism when the patient does need a biopsy. And then in the false negative, where you're looking for low PSAs, we're all in the office running, an hour behind. I'm sure no one else runs an hour behind, but when someone's on a 5-alpha reductase inhibitor, their PSA is, let's say, 2, it really is 4. So if you got to kind of take your time and double the PSA for a gentleman on finasteride and dutasteride. Bottom line is stage migration, decreased death rates. Are we diagnosing more indolent tumors that pose no imminent risk? And how do we reconcile the anxiety and morbidity over overdiagnosis and overtreatment with improved disease-specific survival? And that's with smarter testing. So age-specific PSA as reflects prostate gland growth as men age. So a PSA of 2.5 may be normal for a 60-year-old, but not, a 48-year-old. And so PSA velocity. Again, if someone comes in with a PSA of 2, but last year it was 0.8, that reflects a big jump and may need some further investigation. Free and total PSA. Benign tissue has more free PSA than prostate cancer tissue, and so it's more meaningful at the edges. If the free to total ratio is under 10%, then the patient has a much higher likelihood, over 50%, of having prostate cancer. If the free to total ratio is over 25%, then it's considered low risk for prostate cancer and really significant for usually BPH. And so they have a less than 10% risk of having prostate cancer. Those patients can avoid biopsy. PSA density, unit measurement of PSA per cc of gland tissue. A higher PSA density correlates with advanced pathologic stage, and therefore high PSA density probably not a good candidate for active surveillance. So I'm going to run through these so these guys can get to their talk. But there's numerous tests that we can rule out. Do we need to go through biopsy or not? A couple important ones, 4K score stands for a kallikrein or the protein, total PSA, free PSA, human kallikrein 2, and intact PSA. It reports the percent likelihood of finding high-grade disease, Gleason 7 or higher, on biopsy. The problem is there's no specific cutoff for this test, so it's good information, but it's hard to know where to use it in the armamentarium. There's a test that looks at biopsy tissue that was negative, but if it's adjacent to cancer, there may be field effect changes around the tumor with hypermethylation of promoter DNA regions. And this is really one of the key slides, the multiparametric MRI. So now we can finally see prostate cancer. Radiologists here, Dr. Jonathan Weiner and A.J. Lewis, have developed a protocol that's as good as any around the country. There's a PI-RADS grading system, which stands for Prostate Imaging Reporting and Data System. It's the same as BI-RADS for breast cancer. And so high-grade lesion biopsy is recommended, so we can avoid some biopsies by getting an MRI first. And then we can use an MRI fusion biopsy, which merges the stored MRI images with real-time ultrasound images, and we've done some of the first in Palm Beach County here over the last few months. And basically, this increases the detection of clinically significant cancer while lowering the detection of lower-risk cancer. So if you order this, it's a 3T, and it's got to be multi-parametric is the key way to order this. So what do we do? The American Cancer Society recommends informed decision for men age 50 up until life expectancy is 10 years. We all know here that that's a lot older than 69 years old. Younger age for African-American men, men with a first-degree relative prostate cancer, especially at a younger age, and those with BRCA gene. Other major organizations agree, American Urologic Association, National Comprehensive Cancer Network. And then finally, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force in 2017 issued a draft recommendation that will probably go into effect next year after a comment period that they think screening is okay from 55 to 69. Last point is, so screening is really important so that we maintain the decreased mortality from prostate cancer, but we're going to overdiagnose. And so what do we do with some of those low-risk patients is important, and what we do is we treat them with active surveillance. So those with low stage, low grade, low PSA, low volume disease are eligible to be monitored with PSA and DRE regularly, biopsy every 1 or 2 years, and MRI can be instead of biopsy on off years. And now around the country, 40% of our very low-risk patients are being treated with active surveillance. One final trial, PROTECT trial from New England Journal of Medicine last year, 80,000 men from England screened between ages 50 and 69. They were then randomized to active surveillance, radiation, and surgery. 1,600 of 2,600 men were actually randomized. And at 10 years, there was no difference in mortality, but there was a 2.5 times higher risk of developing metastatic disease in the active surveillance patients compared to surgery or radiation. That's it.
Okay, thank you, David, and thanks, Alan, for the invitation to speak today. So I'm going to get into the nitty-gritty on radiation therapy for prostate cancer. I've included my email address here if anybody has pressing questions or would like a copy of my slides, because I know that this isn't a topic that's placed high emphasis in medical training. First, I want to emphasize that we used to have three categories of prostate cancer: low, intermediate, and high risk. And now there's a move towards more resolution. The low risk category has been split into very low and low, and the intermediate risk category has been split into favorable and unfavorable. And this has brought forth different treatment guidelines, which we respect for each category. And this risk stratification tells you the possibility of microscopic spread outside the capsule, into the seminal vesicles, into the lymph nodes, or even distantly into the bones. So this is for what's obviously clinically localized. There's no radiographic evidence of disease elsewhere, but taking into account the clinical T stage on rectal examination, the PSA, the Gleason score, we can estimate the chances of microscopic disease spread and then make treatment recommendations based on that. So the linear accelerator, also known as the LINAC, is the workhorse in radiation oncology. The experience for the patient each day during treatment is similar to a diagnostic scan. They lie on their back in the supine position. There is this treatment gantry, this gantry head. This is the linear accelerator head, and this will actually rotate around the patient. There is a very complex system of leaves inside the head that will create shape and also modulate the intensity of the radiation beam, and there's more pictures of that to follow. Treatment generally takes about 5 to 20 minutes per session, and I wanted to just talk briefly about how we generate the high-energy X-rays. So basically, this machine is plugged into the wall, and we're taking electrons from electricity, and we're speeding these up inside a vacuum tube near the speed of light. And those are bombarded against a heavy metal target, and then you get a Bremsstrahlung effect, which causes X-ray beam production. In terms of radiation biology, basically we're exerting our effect on cancer by DNA damage, and there are two methods by which radiation has the effect on DNA. Most often in photon radiation, which is what we have at LCI, is the indirect route, whereby radiation converts water into a free radical like hydrogen peroxide, which then goes on to damage the DNA. Other X-ray modalities, such as protons or carbon ions, have more of a direct route, and they have a higher, what we call linear energy transfer. So they actually, per unit of radiation, they have a higher effect on the DNA by directly damaging the DNA. We take advantage of this by treating over many weeks, because the normal body has the ability to repair this DNA damage, whereas the cancer cell cannot. And it's the lack of DNA repair that actually led cancer to become cancer. So we take advantage of this lack of DNA repair mechanism. So in terms of radiation planning, we all come in different shapes and sizes. So radiation is customized and tailored to the individual. We first obtain a diagnostic quality CT scan in the treatment position, and we often fuse an MRI, which can be informative, much more informative than a CT in terms of delineating any changes such as gross extracapsular extension, which we see here. In terms of planning the targets, generally for low-risk cancer, it's just the prostate gland. For intermediate-risk cancer, we include the proximal 2 centimeters of the seminal vesicles. For high-risk cancer, it's controversial whether or not to include the pelvic lymph nodes, and we'll talk more about that briefly. And then we also want to contour the normal tissues and kind of steer around those. Every normal tissue has a different sensitivity for how much radiation it can tolerate. So we contour the rectum, the bladder, the hip bones, the bowel. And then we add margin around the targets to account for any possible microscopic disease extension. There could be uncertainties in setup, so the therapists are trying to get the patient lined up correctly, and we'll talk in a bit about how that occurs, but we know that there could be millimeters of uncertainty in terms of that. And then, of course, there could be organ motion during treatment. It's very plausible that a bubble of gas can move through the rectum and change the geometry of the prostate location. So in terms of setup each day, that's termed image-guided radiation, and we use fiducial markers, which are basically very small gold seeds, just on the order of millimeters, and generally we implant three of these, and each day we take an x-ray and we line the patient up to where the seeds should be so that the patient can actually be shifted, and that way we know we're lining up on the prostate gland. So this is a picture on the right of what a radiation plan typically would look like for an intensity-modulated photon radiation plan. Generally, we use 5 to 7 beams, which are circumferentially arranged around the patient, and they all overlap on the target. You can see here there's a varying thickness of the beam, and that, again, goes back to the leaves that move in and out, so you can modulate the intensity of the beam. And we found that in the prostate cancer experience, giving higher dose to the gland will actually improve outcomes. So increased conformity or increased tightness of your dose cloud is important to minimize exposure to the rectum, to the bladder, in order to accomplish this high dose escalation safely. So back to the pelvic lymph node controversy. There was a study back in the 80s that actually showed it was of no benefit, but there are a lot of people who think that there were serious methodological flaws with that, so there's a new prospective study which is investigating this. But generally, I treat the pelvic lymph nodes for high-risk cancer if they're deemed to be at risk of 15 or 20% above based on the PSA, the T-stage, and the Gleason score. But as you can see, it does introduce more morbidity. There's more bowel exposed. There's more radiation delivered to the patient. In terms of side effects, in my experience, about 50% of patients actually go through radiation and hardly notice any side effects at all. They're fully functional. They play golf. They work, whatever they want to do. The other 50% will have a variable degree of transient side effects, which occur during treatment. Generally, it takes a couple weeks to come on. Then they can accumulate over time, and they'll go away, come back. The patient will feel like normal again 2 to 8 weeks after treatment completes. And really, it's only fatigue, rectal inflammation, which can cause diarrhea, and we encourage hydration. Also, bladder and urethral inflammation, which can cause dysuria, frequency, nocturia. And in terms of long-term complications, more important to talk about, just like surgery, about 30 to 40% will have decreased erectile function, and a lot of that depends on their baseline function before treatment. 20 to 30% will have low-grade changes in urinary or bowel function, so maybe more frequency during the day or at night. Maybe, you know, instead of one stool per day, they might have two. They might be a little bit more loose. 10% of patients will have mild bleeding that's similar to hemorrhoids, so there's maybe blood on the tissue paper. Less than 1% of the time, this bleeding can be significant enough that it's serious. We could even cause an ulcer in the rectum or in the bladder, and this could require surgical intervention. And lastly, 0.4% of patients can experience a radiation-induced cancer, like a bladder or rectal cancer. And I put this picture here because this is often the look I get when I start talking about, you know, we can cause a cancer when we're trying to cure your cancer. This data was based on a 2014 systematic review. It's based on older techniques, though, so there's limited evidence for more modern techniques, but what we have, it seems encouraging. But I think this speaks to the importance of having an up-to-date colonoscopy, because if you have a, you know, tubular villus polyp sitting in the rectum or, you know, some premalignant lesion there, you want to know about that before you start treating, because it can be really problematic to treat a rectal cancer after the area's received radiation. In terms of node-positive prostate cancer, whether this be after surgery and the lymph node is found to be have cancer within it, or on staging CT scan, there's adenopathy in the lymph nodes, there's high-quality data with long-term follow-up that shows that the addition of radiation to ADT improves survival over ADT alone. And you can see the drastic separation in PSA failure here. There's a significant, statistically significant improvement in both death from prostate cancer and overall survival. So it's a message that us radiation oncologists are trying to spread. Even though this paper was published in 2009, there's still a slow diffusion into community practice. Patients are being treated with ADT alone. They're considered metastatic. There's a philosophical thought that once it's in the lymph nodes, it's metastatic, but it's apparent that we can still cure some of these patients. In terms of post-operative radiation, there are two types, adjuvant radiation and salvage radiation. Adjuvant generally is given within 6 months of surgery and is given based on indications on pathology, such as extracapsular spread, cancers poking through the capsule, positive margins, the cancer was cut through, it's coming to the edge of the specimen, so there could be cancer left behind. If the cancer is seen in the seminal vesicles or in the lymph nodes, that's indications for adjuvant radiation. Then there's salvage radiation, which is generally given 6 months after surgery, and that's given for biochemical failure, which after surgery is defined as a PSA greater than or equal to 0.2 on two separate measurements. And this survival curve here is based on 15-year follow-up for adjuvant radiation versus no adjuvant radiation, showing that we can improve survival. However, some will argue that you can just as safely follow a patient with any of these risk factors and see if they fail, if they have a PSA failure, and deliver salvage radiation. So the key question here is whether it's better to radiate the prostate adjuvantly or if it's safe to wait for the PSA to increase. Another modality we have is prostate brachytherapy. Brachytherapy alone is appropriate for very low, and favorable intermediate risk. There are two types of prostate brachytherapy, low dose rate and high dose rate. Low dose rate is the one that's been around longer. It's a permanent seed implant. There's one procedure, 50 to 70 radioactive sources are placed through the gland. There's a rectal ultrasound, and you have visualization of the prostate gland, and then you insert about 15 to 20 hollow catheters, and through those catheters, the seeds are deposited, the goal being to cover the gland completely and spare the urethra, spare the rectum, spare the bladder, and there are good guidelines on how to do that safely. The other type of prostate brachytherapy is called high dose rate, and this is a temporary seed implant, and this has to be done in 2 to 4 procedures. And this is different such that you put the catheters in, but then there's a single source that will travel sequentially through all the catheters. A lot of people are moving towards this because it allows increased customization of the dose cloud that you deliver. The side effects are similar to external beam. They're mainly irritative and obstructive. There's good data that shows out of all the radiation modalities, brachytherapy alone has the lowest rate of erectile dysfunction. There's increasing mounting data for brachytherapy as a boost, and this is appropriate for unfavorable intermediate risk and high risk. And there's recent results of a randomized trial. All patients received 46 gray, which is the unit of measurement for radiation, using external beam, and then they were randomized to a further boost using external beam or brachytherapy. And as you can see, there was an increase in biochemical control with the use of the brachytherapy boost because there was a higher dose to the gland. As you would expect, they're doing better at the expense of higher GU morbidity. It's still too soon to know if the overall survival will be improved. It's going to take much further follow-up. Generally, you need a decade or more. But some believe that this may translate into standard of care in the future if it does show a survival benefit. So you're sacrificing control. You're sacrificing morbidity for improved control. Another modality we have, and this is one that's highly advertised by LCI, is SBRT or stereotactic body radiotherapy. We have a latest model CyberKnife to deliver this. It's much newer. It's only been around for a decade or so. The nice thing is we can get treatment done in 1 week rather than 9 weeks for external beam radiation. The treatments are longer, about 45 minutes per session. This is a linear accelerator mounted on a robot, the same kind of robot that builds cars in Detroit. And basically it can move from any angle, and it delivers hundreds of pencil-sized beamlets from a spherical geometry. The acute side effects are similar to external beam, but generally of a shorter duration. The long-term side effects, we don't have enough experience. So often I'm telling patients, you know, this could be appropriate, but it's still somewhat experimental. We need further follow-up to know what the effect on erectile dysfunction, the rectum, the bladder may be. The higher dose per treatment makes us a little bit nervous about late side effects. In terms of follow-up after radiation, you follow the PSA. Unlike surgery, which you expect the PSA to go to zero, it takes time for the PSA to come down. You're looking for it to come to what we call the nadir, which is the lowest point that it will reach. And generally, patients do better if the nadir comes down to under one. There is a phenomenon called the PSA bounce, which we believe is due to inflammation of the prostate from radiation. And that generally occurs about a year and a half after radiation is delivered. In terms of biochemical failure, so if the cancers come back, that's defined as a PSA nadir plus two. Salvage after radiation. So in the past, it was a commonly spread myth that you can't do surgery after radiation. That's not true. There are experienced urologists who will attempt this, but it should be noted that there are higher rates of morbidity. Many surgeons will tell you if you try to operate on a irradiated tissue, it's much different. It's fibrotic, the vasculature, you know, it's much more difficult to get what you need to get done. Also, it's very important to rule out the presence of metastatic disease. You can also do focal therapy such as brachytherapy after external beam failure. Briefly, androgen deprivation therapy is used concurrently with unfavorable intermediate risk and high risk cancer, 6 months for unfavorable intermediate and 2.5 years for high risk cancer. And it functions to decrease the prostate gland size, so the radiation dose cloud will be smaller. It sensitizes the cancer cell to radiation and theoretically can also result in death of micrometastatic disease. And there's good data that it improves survival when used for these scenarios. In terms of 6 month therapy, we really don't see these more serious systemic side effects such as cardiovascular morbidity, metabolic syndrome. With 6 month therapy, we really see loss of libido, fatigue, and hot flashes. But once you start using it longer, you're getting into a territory where it can cause significant morbidity. If a patient already has moderate to severe comorbidities, we try to avoid using this because there's data that actually shows we can reduce survival in those patients. Newer technologies we've got coming down the road, there's a spacer that we can inject between the prostate and the rectum, and there's data showing that we can reduce the acute toxicity to the rectum. This is a liquid which then solidifies and then it breaks down 6 months later. We also have liquid radiation, or Xofigo, radium-223 dichloride, which is approved in 2013 for metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer. Cancer needs to be predominantly bone only. You can have lymph node involvement, but it needs to be small. It's a calcium-seeking mimetic, so it hones in on the bone. Radium decays into helium, which are alpha particles, which have a highly destructive, very small range. So it's very targeted therapy to the cancer. The treatment is 6 monthly, 1 minute infusions. So it's an injection that we give. It's, in my experience, is very well tolerated. It generally only caused fatigue in my patients, but it can also cause nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. So you encourage hydration. You also check the blood counts before each infusion. And its use is supported by a randomized trial comparing Xofigo to placebo, in which Xofigo improved overall survival. Lastly, I wanted to touch on a controversial topic in prostate cancer, proton radiation. And this chart here is what we call a depth dose curve. So it shows you the photon beam, which is here in red, and then the photon beam, which is what we do with IMRT here at LCI, in green. And you can see that before the tumor and after the tumor, proton results in less radiation delivered. Okay, so, and then we have this spread out Bragg peak. So the Bragg peak is where the proton stops in tissue and then it deposits all its dose. The spread out Bragg peak is, in clinical practice, you need to create proton beams of different intensity so that you can be sure that you're covering the entire tumor. And this is a typical comparison of proton radiation and IMRT. You can see what I want to point out is the high-dose cloud is no different in terms of the red and yellow, but in terms of the blue and green, the lower-dose radiation is markedly reduced with proton radiation. So the key question is, does this decrease in lower radiation dose exposure yield improved clinical outcomes? And, of course, proton radiation, many of you may know, is much higher, magnitudes of order higher in cost than photon radiation. So many of us believe that it doesn't justify the increased cost. We need further evidence to examine this. I was fortunate to be involved in this study that was published in JAMA back in 2012. It was a population-based SEER data study. And basically, we were looking, you know, this is retrospective, so we need to make that caveat, but there was no improvement in cancer control with proton as compared to IMRT. And in fact, there was a suggestion that proton radiation was more dangerous in terms of rectal toxicity. So that speaks to the fact that, you know, it's not just the the physical property of protons that is the only thing you're changing. There are many more differences on the machine. There's uncertainties in where the proton is stopping. There may be changes in image guidance on the proton. So we can't assume that it's better. And this is a summary slide. It shows the treatments for each stage of disease. I'll skip over that, and I am finished with my talk. I'll hand it over to Alan. I got it here.
Where's the arrow that you were able to use?
I'm just using the mouse here.
Okay.
Yep.
I also want to thank the CME committee for allowing us to present this mini symposium to you today. And I want to provide you with the medical oncology perspective. This is an overview of my talk. I want to talk a little bit about the natural history of prostate cancer, some newer therapies that were available only in the last 5 years, immunotherapeutic treatment, and very importantly, discuss the molecular changes that accompany the transition from hormone-sensitive to castration-resistant prostate cancer, because this led to very rational drug development that we have today, and review some of the new hormonal therapies in advanced prostate cancer, and if time, talk about some new and novel strategies. So this is a commonly shown slide, a clinical states model, showing the natural history of prostate cancer from the time that the disease is first diagnosed until the death of the patient. And as a medical oncologist and urologist and radiation oncologist alike, we try to classify patients into castration-sensitive, castration-resistant, whether they're non-metastatic or metastatic, whether they're asymptomatic or symptomatic. We know that about a third of patients who are treated with curative intent, either with radiation or surgery, will recur. It'll be a detectable PSA that leads to the recurrence. And at some point in time, we'll begin these patients on androgen ablation therapy. Typically, a patient will progress after about 18 to 24 months. This disease has a very long natural history, though, because the time from the first detection after these modalities of surgery and radiation to the development of metastatic disease can be, on average, 8 years. We know that from retrospective reviews from Johns Hopkins, where they looked at patients who had had radical prostatectomies, and on average, about 8 years until they developed metastatic disease. About 10 to 20% of men will develop castration-resistant metastatic disease within 5 years of diagnosis. This is a confusing term, castration-resistant. When I was doing my training, we used terms like hormone-resistant, androgen-independent. Generally, we define this as reducing the level of testosterone to less than 50. Some people believe that we should be even more strict and lower it to about 20. These patients are progressing despite this type of androgen ablation, either by rising PSA initially without metastatic disease or eventually radiographic progression. What we know is that many of these tumors remain sensitive to novel androgen receptor antagonists or androgen synthesis inhibitors even after they've gotten chemotherapy at the last stages of their disease. And there's an adaptation that occurs. I'll show you a couple models where there are amplifications and mutations in this driver, the androgen receptor, and also the ability of the cell itself to make its own testosterone. So they're not really truly hormonal resistant in that sense. Once cancer progresses biochemically and the testosterone levels are low, the development of metastatic disease, usually to bone and lymph nodes, occurs very rapidly. This was from a study that we participated in looking at a medication that we were trying to use to delay the development of radiographically present bone metastasis. And as you can see, about half of these men who were screened developed metastatic disease within 2 years. And we talk about PSA doubling times and PSA levels, but this is a busy slide, but it shows that even in patients with low PSA levels, under 7, 7 to 24, or greater than 24, in that orange line, you can still see that there's a significant risk for development of metastatic disease, and the same is true of the PSA doubling times. About 30% of men in this study that we thought had non-metastatic disease were found to have metastatic disease when screened with the old-fashioned technetium bone scans. These are some of the radiographic methods we use, and they all have limitations. CAT scans are sometimes difficult to pick up some of the lower pelvic nodes, the obturator nodes, the hypogastric nodes, and there might be micrometastatic disease present. Bone scans look at osteoblast activity and bone turnover, so they can look at healing, and we can mistake that for metastatic disease. There's been some interest in the radiopharmaceutical industry in developing newer and better imaging materials such as sodium fluoride. We're members here of the National PET Scan Register. We have a grant to look at this. The sensitivity and the specificity are high, but we need a prospective randomized trial to determine their validity. This was the roadmap in 2010. So I was sitting here just 7 years ago, we had very little to offer patients. Secondary hormonal therapies would include bicalutamide and then maybe nalutamide. They weren't entirely cross-resistant. High doses, very high doses of ketoconazole, which caused a lot of GI and liver toxicity. We had one chemotherapy drug that had been approved in 2004, docetaxel, that actually had a survival advantage. But after that, we had very little to offer patients. Mitoxantrone was a drug that was approved back in the 1990s because it had some palliative benefit but no survival benefit. And many of these men went on to receive best supportive care and hospice. I put up this slide because as recently as 2010, as medical oncologists, we saw these patients at the very end of their disease when they were symptomatic. They had, you know, extensive metastatic disease. These tumors infiltrate into the bone marrow, so they have myelophthisis and very poor bone marrow reserve. They're castration resistant. This was not an optimal time, and many of these referrals went right back to the urologist because they weren't fit to get chemotherapy. Since 2010, and really from 2010 to 2013, all of these new therapies have been developed for metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer, and with an overall survival advantage. And the range, the differences are pretty incredible. We have immunotherapy now. We have a better chemotherapy drug, cabazitaxel, which was developed in patients who were resistant to docetaxel that we have been using. We have new generation hormonal therapies, abiraterone and enzalutamide, that I'll talk about. We have medications that can delay the development of skeletal-related events, such as bone pain. Greg referred to radium-223, an alpha particle that's transported with radium and mimics calcium uptake and has been used in symptomatic patients with bone cancer with actually a nice survival advantage. So this is the landscape today as we see it, and we can see that, again, we think about asymptomatic, minimally symptomatic, symptomatic, whether they're castration-sensitive, castration-resistant. But you can see on your left here, the number of different drugs that we use, it's now a challenge to how to sequence these. So I'm going to go through quickly some of these medications that are now approved. Historically, chemotherapy, as I mentioned, was reserved for patients who had high tumor volume, symptomatic disease. We don't see visceral organ involvement to the extent that we do in other solid tumors, but these were the kinds of patients that we were treating before 2010. There was a feeling that maybe if we moved chemotherapy up, just like we do in adjuvant therapy, maybe there were some cells that would be inherently resistant to androgen ablation therapy, and that we might be able to improve the duration of benefit for these patients if we added chemotherapy earlier. And this is a very busy trial, but it was a pivotal trial, the CHARTED trial, was asking the question, is earlier use of chemotherapy at the time we initiate androgen ablation therapy? So these are men who have metastatic disease at onset. There's been a stage migration, so of course we don't see as many of those patients, but at some point they'll develop metastatic disease and they'll be put on standard androgen ablation therapy with a gonadotropin, a releasing hormone analog to lower their testosterone levels. If we use that standard and we add chemotherapy, will that be beneficial? And that was the simple trial design here. The overall survival was the primary endpoint. This was the overall survival in this study. This was for all patients. Patients were randomized to minimal volume metastasis versus extensive metastasis, mostly bone metastasis. We would expect to see a separation of the curves earlier in patients that had a higher tumor burden because they would die from their disease earlier. And we can see here that there was a significant difference if we added chemotherapy. 57.6 months versus 44 months, a hazard ratio of 0.61, meaning that there was a 40% reduction in the risk of dying from prostate cancer in patients who got chemotherapy. And the high volume disease illustrates this even more. The higher the volume, the better that they did. And the lower volume, we all believe that there just haven't been enough events that have occurred. Not enough time has elapsed to see a separation. We're pretty sure we're going to see that. So 6 cycles of docetaxel. This is a microtubular inhibitor, which is historically, the microtubular inhibitors have been the most active drugs in prostate cancer. If you give these patients earlier 6 cycles, in addition to standard androgen deprivation therapy, they do much better. The patients with high volume then again do the best, the patients who had lower volume, I think we just need longer follow-up time to see a difference. What about immunotherapy? This is a brand new area, although the Provenge vaccine has been out since 2010. And this is just a diagram. This could pertain to any cancer, the immunotherapy cell cycle. Basically, you have a tumor that has a tumor-specific antigen. That antigen that sits on the membrane can get shed into the circulation. And it's picked up by a roving dendritic cell or an antigen-presenting cell, and it carries that particle to a lymph node where it gets primed and activated, then traffics back to the tumor and can infiltrate. These are tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes right into the tumor. The problem is when that first contact between the T cell, the TIL cell we call it, is a CD8 cell, and it engages a ligand on the tumor, the immune system is actually hijacked initially, and all other T cells are turned off. Therapeutically, if we can block the interaction or engagement initially with an antibody, either PD-L on the tumor cell or PD-1 on the T cell, we can restore the immune system's ability to enter the cancer cell and basically kill it. That's called PD-L blockade. Provenge is works more at that priming station earlier on. It takes the patient's own cells. It has to fuse onto it a target that the dendritic cells can recognize, in this case, prostatic-specific antigen, and there's an adjuvant GM-CSF that it's fused with. Then the patient goes and has his cells harvested. He's treated on day 1, day 15, and day 30. takes about a month, and I'll show you the results of this particular trial. I'm just going to show briefly the leukapheresis of the patient's mononuclear cells, the fusion of the antibody onto the antigen onto the antigen-presenting cell, its enrichment and maturation, and then its injection back into the patient, and its attack on the T cell. And this is a very busy slide, but basically we had asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic patients who were randomized to cipolucel T, which is Provenge versus a control. They were treated until progression, and overall survival was a primary endpoint. Those that had gotten the vaccine initially, went on to continue getting it. Those that didn't could get it. Sometimes that confounds survival, but there was a definite survival advantage here, showing a benefit for cipolucel T that was very durable, 25.8 months versus 21.7 months. And across all ages, performance status, Gleason scores, even higher Gleason scores in patients with more extensive disease benefited from this. But what I want to show here is patient selection. If you give this therapy, you need to give it early. You need to give it when PSAs are generally 20 or below, and perhaps with fewer bone lesions, maybe four or less. You can see that the magnitude of effect in the lowest quartile, where the PSA is low and the tumor burden is low, is the greatest. And it's least when you have PSAs over 100 and extensive disease. So you have to treat these patients earlier if you're going to give it. The other confounding problem is that we don't know when the immune system is going to get activated. It could be very delayed. And even more perplexing is we don't have a biomarker to assess response. So PSA does not work as a gauge of response. And what happens in the clinic is that patients get this vaccine earlier, they're followed, their PSA goes up, and they're on to something else. This is another type of vaccine. Instead of targeting PAP, it targets PSA. It's linked to an adjuvant trichome. The dendritic cells take up a PROSPAC. They attack anti-PSA cells in a manner similar to Provenge. This was the PROSPAC study that was presented a number of years ago. It was a phase 2 study. You can see a difference in survival from with the PROSPAC versus placebo. And this is a very pivotal trial that's going to be reported out in the fourth quarter of this year. I think this is a better patient selection because these patients have less metastatic disease at a time when their immune system is more robust to begin with. And the endpoint is overall survival for this trial. So we're eagerly awaiting the results of PROSPECT. Again, this slide is another of the clinical states models, but again, showing that the activation of the androgen receptor in the cell is very pivotal throughout the whole course of this disease from the time of diagnosis. And there are several models that explain why some of these cells, over time, it can be months and sometimes years, adapt to their environment. We may, in the selection model that's on your left, we may see coexisting heterogeneous prostate cancer cells, a population in which some of the sensitive cells are killed and the resistant cells survive. But I think what was more important for rational drug development was the adaptation model. You have androgen-resistant prostate cancer cells that develop a particular molecular phenotype that's different from the same receptor in a sensitive cell that's next to it. There's a clonal expansion of these resistant cells over time. So there is a selection, but there's also an adaptation. The key driver is the androgen receptor. The androgen receptor is in the cytoplasm of the cell. The cell is basically, at this point, devoid of testosterone. It has been for months or years. But the androgen receptor gets activated by whatever testosterone is available. The first-generation drugs like bicalutamide were weak androgen receptor inhibitors, and their mechanism of action ended there. In order for this cell to survive that initial activation of the androgen receptor, has to translocate to the nucleus and then interact with the patient's DNA. So what happens is this androgen receptor is upregulated. There are more of these receptors that are available in these resistant cells, so that would increase the probability of binding to testosterone. There's also a promiscuity that occurs. These androgen receptors don't need dihydrotestosterone, the active form of testosterone, to activate them. They can be activated by estrogens like estradiol. They can be activated by steroids and progesterone. They're not so selective in what they need to activate them. And there are some androgen-independent activation. These are constitutively activated without any ligand. So these are some of the changes that occur. And finally, and this is kind of amazing, the resistant cell becomes an endocrine organ. It takes the same enzymatic pathway that the testes, the Leydig cells, and the adrenal gland does to manufacture testosterone. It makes its own testosterone. It takes cholesterol, converts it to pregnenolone, and then through a very important CYP17 hydroxylase enzyme, it converts it to the precursors of testosterone in humans, DHEA and androstenedione, and then to testosterone, and then the activation to a more potent form, DHT, in the cell. So the pharmaceutical companies, the research and development groups, found a medication that could irreversibly block that from happening, preventing the androgen-resistant cell from making its own testosterone. The example that I'm showing here is with abiraterone. It's an androgen biosynthesis inhibitor. It blocks in two steps cholesterol from being converted eventually to testosterone, irreversibly and very potently. One of the things it also does that's not that desirable is that it blocks the mineralocorticoid pathway, so these patients have low cortisol levels and they have to be given concurrent prednisone with their treatments. But proof of principle showed, again, initially after chemotherapy, and this is where we didn't think hormone therapy would ever work, but after chemotherapy, one or two rounds of chemotherapy, toward the end of their disease, these therapies were introduced to patients, and you can see a very early separation of the curve on this Kaplan-Meier plot here, where there was a median overall survival benefit for patients who had abiraterone after they had fairly extensive disease, poor performance status, and had prior rounds of chemotherapy. This was reported out in 2011 initially, and in February of 2012 it was approved. So obviously the next step is, well, why not move it up earlier where we would use hormonal therapy? Maybe it would work at that point too. And this was the Cougar 302 study looking at chemotherapy-naive patients. These patients were randomized to get the abiraterone or placebo. The primary endpoint was radiographic progression-free survival, so delaying the development of further metastatic disease, usually in bone, or even more importantly, overall survival. And clinically useful secondary endpoints were also looked at, like could we delay the need for pain medication? Could we delay the time that we need the initiation of chemotherapy? What about their performance status? Could we maintain that so they were functional and able to do all their activities of daily living? And could we delay the time to PSA progression? And the answer was there was a survival advantage here. About half these patients came in on prednisone. If we adjusted for that, the survival benefit was greater here, and the secondary endpoints that were shown here, clinically relevant, were all better in the group that got the abiraterone. The other thing that happens is that, again, the receptors are less particular about what will activate them. You need a drug that's going to be very potently involved that would prevent the initial binding, much more so than bicalutamide. But you need more than that. Bicalutamide's action ends there. It has no effect on shrinking tumors. It just delays the tumors from enlarging. This drug not only potently blocks the androgen receptor. It's like putting a piece of tape in front of your car key, and again, so it can't get into the ignition switch. It just can't engage and bind to it. And even if it could, it can't translocate to the nucleus. This was a whole new mechanism of action. It can't get the activated receptor to the nucleus, and it then, even if it could, it can't interact with DNA, so it's triple androgen blockade. Very important discovery. The same types of clinical trials were done with these compounds, first after chemotherapy, advanced disease, Kaplan-Meier showing a very nice separation of the curves over time. Median overall survival was considerably better, and the hazard ratio was 0.63, so a 37% reduction in the risk of dying from prostate cancer in patients after chemotherapy who got this treatment. And then before chemotherapy, again, a very similar design to what I showed you for abiraterone, where the patients were randomized to get enzalutamide or placebo, primary endpoint overall survival and progression-free survival. Here's the Kaplan-Meier curve showing a benefit for that. So very rational drug development based on molecular phenotypic changes that occur in these receptors. It's still a heterogeneous population, so when patients say, why are you still giving me Lupron? My PSA is going up. I tell them because it is still suppressing some of these genes at different, some of these cells at different points in time, this molecular phenotype is going to take over and become the predominant population here. One of the problems that we have is now we have these two drugs. They work quite differently. They both work in the same settings. How do we choose which one to use? How do we sequence them? We know that whatever we give first, if it's enzalutamide or if it's abiraterone, once we switch when they progress on the initial one, the response rates are blunted. So that's telling us that they're, although they work differently, they have kind of complementary mechanisms of action. They have non-overlapping side effects. Whatever we use doesn't work as well later. Is there anything that we could do to help us choose what to cross over to? And one of the new thoughts is that we can isolate these circulating tumor cells. These are cells that are at the primary metastatic site. They get passively shed into the circulation. It's a tough environment for them. There are a lot of shearing forces that take place. They're under a lot of stress. There are roving cells in the immune system in the bloodstream that are trying to pluck them out of the circulation, but somehow they survive. They get out of the blood vessels and into tissue. Then either in initially a dormant state, but eventually grow as the tumor. And this was what we think, this is what we think are some of the clinical applications, earlier cancer detection. Disease staging, monitoring for recurrence. We can use it for prognostication, but most importantly, it may be an aid in selection of therapy. We may be able to predict which patients are more likely to respond to these androgen receptor targeted therapies that I mentioned, or maybe should go on to get chemotherapy. This was an article that appeared in JAMA just this last December, looking at this, one of the mechanisms of resistance being a splice variant 7. This is a splice variant mutation in the androgen receptor itself, and it's carried in these circulating tumor cells. And can we use this as a biomarker in outcome and survival? And what was found was if you isolated these cells and they had the AR splice variant 7 mutation, that would indicate that they would be more resistant to these new androgen, these new hormonal therapies. They would have a shorter duration of benefit, a shorter time to development of further metastasis, usually in the bone, an inferior overall survival. And there was a significant interaction with taxane administration. They actually worked better in patients who would go on to get chemotherapy. So this just shows that if you have a patient who pre-treatment has this mutation, they would do better with taxane therapy than they would with hormonal therapy. And as they go on and get more rounds of treatment, we have a higher yield of these AR-positive samples. So it may be that if a person got abiraterone, and we tested before, during, and after, if there were more cells that expressed this AR splice variant 7 mutation, we might want to go from abiraterone to a chemotherapy drug like cabazitaxel or enzalutamide to cabazitaxel, and then maybe back to the other hormonal therapy. And then this is, again, is just a curve showing in that orange line that if you had, before starting therapy, this mutation, you can see that with the typical hormonal therapy, curve was very short in terms of survival, 4.6 months. If it was negative, these patients in blue did well, but even though they did not do as well as the patients who had the positive mutation, they still had a median survival that was 8.9 months versus 4.6 months. So this is not commercially available yet. It's under an intense investigation. It may help us determine the possible sequence. And I'll just finish by showing you this, where I think we're going here. You heard Louise Morel talk about germline mutations. In prostate cancer, it turns out that if patients have a family history of ovarian cancer, breast cancer, or prostate cancer on the mother's and father's side of the family, they should be routinely tested now for BRCA2 and BRCA1 and another targeting gene ATM, another germline gene ATM, because they have, as was shown by David, there's a high percentage of patients that are BRCA positive. Why is that important? Because there are genes that help cancer cells repair their DNA damage. Cancer cells can remain, can survive because they have the ability to repair their DNA. Chemotherapy prevents that from happening. PARP are called homologous deficiency recombination genes, and BRCA2 is a member of that. So we can prevent the cancer cell from repairing its DNA damage if they're BRCA2 positive by administering some of these new PARP inhibitors. This is an example of olaparib. This was published a couple years ago in the New England Journal of Medicine. And again, it's a busy slide, but the point is that it was very effective in BRCA2 patients after they'd been through chemotherapy and hormonal therapy. This is a response here that you can see with this. It's not projecting very well, but there were objective responses. And we're doing a study here with a PARP inhibitor, rucaparib, in patients who have these homologous recombination deficiencies. We're preventing the cell from repairing its DNA damage. We're looking forward to that. Another example would be signaling pathways. There's an mTOR pathway. We know it better in renal cell carcinoma, but basically it gets amplified in prostate cancer as a signaling pathway that promotes tumor cell growth. Patients who have PTEN loss, as it's called, they have a poorer prognosis in prostate cancer. And so we can test in our genomic testing the PTEN a pathway, and if there's PTEN loss, there has been improvement when we combine it with abiraterone. And so this is a clinical trial we're doing with a PTEN signal inhibitor, epitacitab, and we're looking at that with abiraterone versus abiraterone alone. And finally, just revisiting anti-PD-1 activity. If you watch television, you see ads all the time for Opdivo and Keytruda, and they work in so many different types of cancers, melanoma, lung cancer, head and neck cancer now, Hodgkin lymphoma, and more to come. But prostate cancer has been a major disappointment here. It has a low mutation rate. There's a limited ability for these infiltrating T cells to get into the tumor compared with melanoma and non-small cell lung cancer, to name a few. The clinical trials with nivolumab, a PD-1 antibody, have been very disappointing with no responses. But a very intriguing report from ESMO, the European Society of Medical Oncology, in October, that patients who had progressed on enzalutamide when they were given pembrolizumab or Keytruda, they had some amazing responses. The first 3 of 10 patients responded. One patient had a PSA of 2,500 after getting pembrolizumab while continuing on the enzalutamide. His PSA went to less than 0.02 from 2,500 pretty rapidly. And there were actually some very nice clinical responses in these patients. So when they biopsied these patients, they saw tumor CD30 or tumor infiltrating cells into the tumor, and they saw an enhanced PD-1 expression, the ligand on the tumor cell. So this is a trial that we're opening up here, looking at another type of PD-L antibody, atezolizumab, with enzalutamide. There's a lead-in period, and then comparing it with enzalutamide alone. So I just want to summarize my conclusions here, that the insights into the adaptive changes that accompany the transition from castration-sensitive to castration-resistant have really provided us with rational drug development. We now have better hormonal therapy than we have before. There are now third-generation androgen receptor signaling inhibitors and these CYP17 inhibitors that are going to be hopefully introduced in the next couple years. Chemotherapy, previously reserved for very advanced disease patients, should be given to every patient who's fit to get chemotherapy with an extensive tumor burden earlier, not later. Immune therapy should be given in patients who are asymptomatic and have PSAs generally less than 20 and a low tumor burden in the bone. And I just mentioned PARP inhibitor is a promising therapeutic target in patients who are BRCA2 mutated. So that's my talk. I ran a little bit over, but again, I want to thank everybody for coming.